at Case Western Reserve University, at The Ohio State University, and at dozens of other universities and colleges across the country, students outraged over the Israel-Hamas war have set up encampments and joined protests calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and demanding divestment from Israel. Critics have called some of the protests anti-Semitic and a threat to the Jewish populations on those campuses. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. This hour, we'll talk about the protests happening locally, in Columbus, and nationwide with the reporters covering them. We'll hear what protesters, Hillel organizations, and the college administrations are doing and saying about the protests, most of which have been peaceful. Later, a conversation with an eyewitness to the May 4th shooting on the Kent State campus that left four students dead on its 54th anniversary. Those conversations coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us. In recent weeks, a growing number of protests on university campuses have swept across the nation, from Columbia University to UCLA. Broadly, the protesters have decried the loss of Palestinian lives in the Israel-Hamas war. They've called for a ceasefire in Gaza and have called for their universities and colleges to divest from Israel. To date, over 34,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, and 1,200 Israelis were killed in the Hamas terror attack on October 7th, where 253 people were taken hostage, and 130 hostages remain, their status unknown. That's according to Israel. Protests have sprung up on campuses in Ohio, including on the campus of The Ohio State University, where last week a pro-ceasefire protest ended with 40 protesters arrested. Last night, protesters returned with faculty and student support, and the protests ended peacefully. And for the past three nights on the campus of Case Western Reserve University, protesters have set up encampments as part of their movement. While most of the protests nationwide have been peaceful, on some campuses the situation has devolved, including at Columbia, where there were clashes between protesters and police, and on the UCLA campus, where fighting occurred between pro-Palestine protesters and counter-protesters. University and college administrations have been in a tenuous situation of attempting to honor the protesters' First Amendment rights, while also attempting to maintain order on campus and protecting the safety and interests of the entire student body. This hour, we're going to take a look at the protests through the vantage points of the reporters covering them. Joining me now for this conversation, we have Stephanie Saul, a reporter with the New York Times covering colleges and universities, and a Cleveland native. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you, Jenny.
We have George Shilcock, a reporter for WOSU in Columbus. George, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And joining me in studio, our own Connor Morris, education reporter from IdeaStream Public Media. Connor, glad to have you.
Howdy, glad to be here.
And if you have a question or a comment and would like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. All right, George, you were on the campus of The Ohio State University last night. Tell us about the character of those protests and what people were saying there.
Yeah, so this protest, they started gathering around 5:50 p.m. At the South Oval. If you don't know and aren't familiar with Ohio State's campus, this is sort of the big green lawn area out back of the Ohio Student Union just off High Street. Now, for the most part, for the entirety of this protest, they were peaceful. They were sitting around, they were chanting. A lot of the Muslim people there took intermittent breaks to pray. And then they were also passing out food, watermelons, like falafel was something that they were passing out as well. And during this time, there was a police presence there, police on bikes and some squad cars just sort of sitting there watching. Eventually, this did break up in about 3 hours later, but yeah, overall, very, very peaceful.
And I know that you spoke with a professor who participated in the protests as a show of solidarity, and we actually have a cut from him. So let's hear what he has to say.
faculty and staff coming together like this in my 20 years at Ohio State, I've never seen this kind of willingness to mobilize on the ground to support a student protest.
And that was Dr. Pranav Jani. So can you elaborate more on kind of what his sentiments were, George?
Yeah, so I first encountered Dr. Jani when he led a crowd of about 100 faculty and staff to where the students were already gathering. He also spoke through a loudspeaker in the center of this ring that the protesters had made up. Dr. Jani, he's also the faculty advisor for OSU's Students for Justice in Palestine. He made it pretty clear, both when he was speaking over loudspeaker and to me, that he really wants to sort of refocus these protests that are happening around the country on what is happening in Gaza. He said specifically, this is about Gaza, and if we don't talk about Gaza and only talk about free speech, then he thinks people are doing a disservice to understanding why these students' speeches, in his view, being suppressed.
Stephanie, when you hear George talk about what happened on the OSU campus, and there was one last Thursday night on the OSU campus as well, how does that track when it comes to the overall picture of campus protests happening throughout the country?
Well, Jenny, I think generally the campus protests around the country have been peaceful. We did see some violence recently at UCLA, and police moved in there. We saw broken windows at Columbia recently, but not no major violence at most other campuses. In fact, there's been singing. There's been at Columbia, they had Passover dinner, they had prayers. It's generally been fairly peaceful.
But then, as you said, and I know that you're based in New York, if I'm understanding that right, Columbia University, the administration there a couple nights ago said it was left with no choice but to call in police because the situation was untenable. So can you talk more specifically about Columbia and why you think there was more of a, the situation seemed to devolve?
Well, I think what we've seen over the past week nationally are protests that were ignited by what happened at Columbia on April 18th. And that was when the university's leadership called police to campus essentially one day or within 48 hours after an encampment had been set up. That was widely criticized by the Columbia faculty. In fact, the University Senate, which is made up primarily of faculty members, has launched an investigation because they felt that it was unnecessary for the Columbia administration to call in police for a peaceful protest. And, the mindset dating back to 1970, when shootings occurred at Kent State, is that it is only if lives are in danger or there's an imminent threat, do universities call in police. So because of that, and the decision at Columbia, I believe that's why these protests have spread around the country. And then more recently, when Columbia students moved into a building and occupied a building and there were windows broken, et cetera, Columbia called in the police again.
And I was listening to NPR this morning with an interview with New York Mayor Eric Adams, who was saying, the students are allowed their freedom of speech and First Amendment rights. But when you start getting violent or, even attacking and damaging property, that's when the line is crossed. So do you think ultimately that is kind of where the administration has to draw some sort of line? Or where they are expressing themselves as needing to do that?
they seem to have said even initially that even when the protest was entirely peaceful, that they felt that there was some sort of imminent danger, but that was on April 18th. Despite that, the faculty have broadly criticized that decision.
I see. All right, great. Connor, you've been following the protests on Case Western Reserve University's campus and have spoken to students about why they're protesting, including Youssef Khalaf, president of the campus chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine. Let's hear what he had to say.
The relationship is completely tainted. They are completely disconnected from the student body. They don't understand why their students don't want to invest in a genocide. They don't want their university to be profiting off the blood of our people, to be profiting off the blood of 15,000 dead children. That's why we're here.
Yeah, and he's speaking there about the university administration. And we should note Khalaf is Palestinian-American, too, as well. So the students occupied the Oval outside the university library going on 4 days now. They've camped out overnight each time. The university initially had a bit of a what students would, argue is a pretty harsh response. They were setting up kind of tents, and the university called police in and dragged students out of the tents, detained them, about 20 of them, and took the tents down. And the university's position was that they didn't want people camping out there. Their stance has softened since. You can see tents on the Oval now back there. And folks have been allowed to stay overnight. So they've kind of had a shifting approach. And we did talk to, a couple of administrators as well there. And we talked to Peter Whiting, who's, the interim VP for Student Affairs.
Yeah, let's hear what he had to say.
Our approach is students are welcome to express themselves, but they have to do it in a way that is appropriate in its time, place, and manner. We're saying sort of daylight hours, place, in a place that doesn't sort of otherwise disturb university operations. This is a place that is fine.
And so that was on Monday, and so they've actually kind of shifted since, and it is finals week as well too. So maybe one part of the gambit here might be that they think students might be heading out as summer break gets going here. So why not let them camp out for the final few days at school?
And it really does seem, watching these campus protests and how administrations are responding, that it really is contingent on the place and location and the
yes.
dynamics and the tensions and what's happening on each campus is unique. Although, again, if you're watching, it seems relatively peaceful, except for some of these protests that are getting the most media attention, candidly, because there is violence that seems, or clashes that are happening either between protesters or between protesters like at Columbia and police.
Sure. And, it's important to, make the distinction to, who is causing violence? Is it students? Are there folks that are coming in from, who are just activists themselves who are not necessarily part of the student body? And characterize what is violence, too? Is it police coming up upon protesters and asking them to move and protesters pushing back? Is that being instigated by police or is that being instigated by protesters? So there's a lot of nuance here that gets kind of lost as we kind of have these conversations.
Let's hear from Sabrina, who is calling in. She is a student at Case Western who has been involved in these protests. Sabrina, good morning.
Good morning.
So I would love to hear from your perspective why you think it is so important that your student colleagues come out and protest and give voice to this issue.
The university has not been meeting our demands for a while now. So far before October 7th, actually about a year ago now, we democratically got a resolution passed through our undergraduate student body called Resolution 31-15. And what this resolution asked of the university was to be transparent about its investments into not only the military-industrial complex at large, but also specifically companies that are now aiding and abetting the Israeli genocide. And so we passed that about a year ago, only to receive extreme backlash from the university, who said that they would not be honoring the resolution at all, calling it anti-Semitic. And essentially, it created a lot of tension on campus, especially for Palestinian students and pro-Palestinian activists. And so what we are here doing now is making sure that we are sat in a central location on campus here to stay, making sure that the university can no longer just walk past us, just ignore us, and making sure that we are able at the end of the day to make some big moves on divesting from the military-industrial complex, and especially as it relates to the state of Israel.
And of course, Israel and the United States, their position on and when using the term genocide is that this was a military reaction to the October 7th terrorist attacks, which again claimed nearly 1,400 lives. And there's 130 people remaining as hostages, and their status is unknown. I want to ask, Sabrina, when people say that these protests inherently or, you know, factions of the protests on certain campuses are anti-Semitic, what's your response to that?
Being situated where we are located in Cleveland, Ohio, we are actually surrounded by a pretty prolific Jewish community. And if there is one thing that we have definitely very much appreciated this entire time, it has been Jewish presence at our encampment. So that's not only just been members of Jewish Voices for Peace, but just general members of the Jewish community here on campus, Jewish community at large that resides in Cleveland but isn't affiliated. And what they have specifically made it known to us is that they want their presence to be there to dismantle myths such as the phrase "from the river to the sea" being anti-Semitic, as well as making it known to Jewish students on campus that there are other Jewish people that are involved in planning and organizing with the encampment, as well as just spending some extra time there. And so we are very much cognizant of the political tensions and the social tensions that arise out of these encampments. But if there is one thing that we have been well assured by members of the Jewish community here and by a significant proportion of Jewish members of the community here, it is that we are not trying to spread any hate, anti-Semitism. And at the end of the day, our mission is to center justice. And as I have been saying this whole time, justice for some, including justice for Palestinians, is justice for all.
All right. Well, Sabrina, I appreciate you calling in and sharing your perspective with us this morning. You know, I want to stay on the topic of anti-Semitism, because critics nationwide, some critics nationwide and national Jewish organizations have said that these protests and then particular actions on some of these protests on campuses are anti-Semitic. And I'm wondering from a reporter's perspective, Stephanie, what have you seen when it comes to the nature of these protests and what messages are being sent?
You know, I've seen a very broad variety of criticisms of this. I've heard a variety of chants that were interpreted as anti-Semitic. I've also, though, talked to a number of Jewish students who are involved in the protests. So it seems to be a, really broad cross-section. And I know that some Jewish students have left Columbia for the semester because they say that, and they're studying remotely because they say that they were fearful. But on the other hand, I think something like of the 108 students at Columbia who were arrested on April 18th, I think 16 of them were Jewish and who were involved in the protests. So I think it, and I've also spoken to students who were protesting at Brown who are Jewish, and students at Penn who are Jewish, who were involved in the protests. So, you know, I think it just, you know, like any other group, it's not monolithic. I think it just, there's a wide variety of reactions and feelings to what's going on among Jews.
And George, I understand on the Ohio State University campus, you actually spoke with Sarah Deitch, the director of the Chabad House, about the protests. Let's hear what she had to say.
I am here because I am not a weak Jew with trembling knees. And when they protest and try to decimate Zionism, and they try to announce and pronounce accusations against Israel that are absolutely unfounded and untrue, and they scream things like "the Zionists must go," I will come so that they can see that the Jews are not going anywhere.
And I would say, George, and what was your impressions being on the campus? Did you feel like this sentiment was in the minority, or do you think it represents, you know, a certain faction of the people living in Columbus going to the OSU?
So I've spoken to multiple Jewish people at these protests, including Sarah, who she and a couple other people were parked on the side of last Thursday's protests, draped in Israeli flags. I also spoke to OSU Hillel President Jeremy Davis, and he echoed Sarah, saying that like chants like Zionists have got to go to him because he calls himself a Zionist. To him, that is anti-Semitism. But to many of the people that are also helping organize these protests with Jewish Voices for Peace, they are there in support of this. Jeremy Davis did say on All Sides, a quote that has been sticking with me. He again is the OSU Hillel president, that for every Jewish person, he believes there's three opinions. And there's this vast amount of opinions among the Jewish people, both opposing these protests and supporting them.
That's an interesting quote. Let's go ahead and take a call from John in Canton. John, thanks for calling in. What's your thought?
Yes, I think this artificially manufactured slander that these protests are anti-Semitic is very calculated by a powerful section of the military-industrial complex, and the Israeli lobby is one of the most intense factions within that. It's a dirty lie. It's a cheap shot, dirty, rotten, verbal slander trick to say that if you object to spending billions of dollars providing thousands of 2,000-pound bombs to bomb the most densely packed, one of the most densely packed open air prison areas there, like fish in a barrel, to kill millions, I should say, at this point, approaching 40,000 women and children.
All right, John.
It's ridiculous to call that anti-Semitic. It's a dirty trick, and these right wing talk show hosts.
Okay, John, I appreciate
it. As the outside agitators at the right-wing talk show.
Okay, John, I appreciate your thought. Yeah, you've made it clearly. Thank you. And certainly that's a perspective shared by many involved in protests against this war and concerned about the humanitarian toll in Gaza. Now, Stephanie, you've been reporting on this for quite a while, since the October 7th terrorist attacks happened. And I'm curious, how have big donors who take a vocal stand on the Israel-Hamas war played into, do you think, where universities stand or what their behavior is when it comes to protesters on their campus?
Well, we saw this last fall, primarily at Penn and Harvard. There was more or less a donor revolt. At the University of Pennsylvania, it was led by Mark Rowan, who's a big hedge fund guy in New York and a huge donor to Penn, as well as a number of other folks, ranging from Ronald Lauder of the Estee Lauder company fame and Dick Wolf, the television producer, all saying that they were going to take their money away from Penn. So I think, and similar things were going on at Harvard, so I think donors have played a very prominent role in all this. More recently, we saw Robert Kraft, the Boston Patriots owner, who's a Columbia alum, threatening to pull money out of Columbia. So, donors have played a huge role, and of course, all these universities are trying to get the biggest endowments they can, and even no endowment is big enough,
Right.
They're always trying to get more.
So that's definitely a subtext, you think, to what plays into the rationale or the behavior of universities when it comes to how to handle, let's say, protests like these on their campuses.
Absolutely. And at Penn, this was going on even before the Hamas attacked Israel. There was a big fight over a Palestinian literary conference there, and donors were threatening to pull support. That occurred last September. Hmm. So this has been brewing even before the attack and even before the war broke out.
Let's take a quick break, and when we return very shortly, we'll continue this conversation about the campus protests around the nation and here in Ohio. I'm Jenny Hamill. This is The Sound of Ideas. We'll be right back. I'm Jenny Hamill. This is The Sound of Ideas. Thanks for staying with us this hour. We are having a conversation about the campus protests all across the country and here in Ohio with the reporters covering them. I'm joined by Stephanie Saul of the New York Times, George Shilcock with WOSU, and Connor Morris with our own IdeaStream Public Media. Now, I do want to read an email from Peggy in Oberlin, who writes, "My daughter, an OSU graduating senior, was denied her high school graduation due to COVID. She was her high school valedictorian, is now going to graduate magna cum laude with a double major at the OSU. Please keep commencement. These students have worked so hard. In closing, I participated in many protests while in college. The students should feel the right to protest peacefully, but respect their graduating seniors." So, George, I wonder, what is your impression, or at least what is your reporting telling you when you're looking into how the protests are impacting the student body as a whole and just the processes and schedules of classes and whatnot?
So this week was actually the final week of exams. They wrapped up Tuesday. The students went out on their bar crawl. We could see from the WOSU newsroom. These protests started, of course, last week, and the university was pretty quick last week to begin arresting people when these protests occurred. It was 41 total from Tuesday to Thursday. Now the exam week is done, like the protests yesterday, it was mostly peaceful, and the police let it happen, weren't trying to break it up, and didn't even threaten to break it up during that. The commencement is coming up, and Ohio State officials have told us that they're still planning to put it on, that they're not going to let any of these protests, if they even try to, disrupt the commencement. And protesters haven't indicated yet that they'd even try. Ohio State President Ted Carter, who started just this past year, he gave a pretty poignant quote in a statement to us, saying that he's not going to let Ohio State's campus be overtaken by these what the university has called like disruptive protests.
And what's the response at Case Western when it comes to making a shift, Connor, with any of their scheduling or any of the activity on campus?
Yeah, so the faculty senate meeting went on virtual only, and there were a couple of things like that where, they kind of shifted operations a little bit. But really, the protest is just kind of in a central part of campus. They're not blocking sidewalks or anything. Folks are showing up in support, circling around them, and chanting, a couple nights ago when I was there. So it really hasn't impacted any operations really that I'd seen. And students would argue as well that they're just there to kind of have their voices heard, and they're not really. And that's the interesting kind of calculus that a lot of these universities are making, as we heard earlier, from the administrator. It's all about time, manner, and place of the protest.
Let's hear from Francis, who's been waiting on the line patiently, calling in from Columbus. Good morning, Francis. Go ahead.
Yes, as old as I am, which is the age of 85, I've watched these protests and these problems in the Middle East for many, many years, and have come to the conclusion that these go back all the way to Israel and Ishmael and Abraham. And these people have been fighting ever since then. And frankly, I don't think they're ever going to stop. And my one question is, what did the Jews ever do to be treated the way they have since the Old Testament? I don't understand.
All right. Well, Francis, I appreciate your thoughts, and thanks for listening to the show. I do want to read an email, actually, from Jacob Isaacson, Jared Isaacson, who just wrote in from Cleveland Hillel. We were trying to get him on the show, wrote in and said, I wanted to add that as Hillel operating in Cleveland and at Case Western Reserve University, we are totally focused on supporting our Jewish students' needs, as we always have. We feel that no student, Jewish and all others, should ever feel marginalized or unsafe or unwelcome on campus. So we are committed to offering a safe space and welcome during finals when, for example, Jewish students feel they can't even go to the library or study as any normal student should be at this time of year. I have to go on and say, I have concerns when protesters point to Jewish community members who support their protests, as it is important to note that a very small minority of Jews are anti-Zionists, and they are not representative of the vast majority of Jews, and using them as such amounts to tokenization. Jared, I appreciate you writing in. Now, Stephanie, on a national scale, I wonder, how will you be watching these protests, and where will your reporting take you next?
Well, I think, you know, as you mentioned, we're going to be watching very carefully graduation ceremonies and how, if at all, graduation is affected by this. And, you know, of course, we're hearing from students whose lives have been disrupted by COVID and now this, and they're very upset about it. And of course, graduation, the main graduation ceremony has already been canceled at the University of Southern California, where they had planned to have John M. Chu, the Crazy Rich Asians director, as a speaker, and also to honor Billie Jean King. Mm. That's off. So far, that's the only graduation ceremony that I know of that's been affected by the controversy over the war in Gaza. And I think that was also a motivating factor of Columbia, in that the place where the encampment was located is generally where the audience at Columbia's graduation, which is quite a large audience, and that's generally where they sit, where the chairs are set up. So I think everybody's concerned about going forward with graduation ceremonies.
And George, on the OSU campus, are there plans for more protests? And how are the students feeling about how they have been treated by the administration in potentially having more assemblies and more speeches and more protests?
Yeah, so we found out yesterday at the protest that they do plan on gathering again on the South Oval Friday at 1:30 p.m. This is much earlier than past protests. On graduation, I do want to say I've spoken to two students who have opined to me on that. One is the OSU Hillel president, who said he is worried about graduation coming up. But then also Courtney DeRoach, who is a OSU graduate instructor, she was arrested on Thursday, and she gave her dissertation literally hours after her planned arraignment on Monday. She got her arraignment was at 9 a.m. and she had to rush over to give her dissertation at 1. So people are generally, like, on both sides seeing, like, the impact of this on their graduation ceremonies going forward.
Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I appreciate your involvement in this conversation. Stephanie Saul, reporter with The New York Times, George Shilcock, a reporter for WOSU, and our own Connor Morris, IdeaStream Public Media's education reporter. Thank you three for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time now for a quick break. When we return, we will remember a similar moment to these campus protests that occurred 54 years ago this weekend to discuss the May 4th shootings at Kent State University that occurred back in 1970. We're going to talk to someone who was an eyewitness at the time. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. We have been discussing the protests for the duration of the program, these protests around the country concerning the war in Gaza. The civil unrest on college campuses has some comparing the tension on campus now and the police involvement to the anti-war protests of the late 1960s, early 70s. This Saturday marks the 54th anniversary of the shootings at Kent State when Ohio National Guard soldiers opened fire on unarmed student demonstrators on May 4th, 1970, killing four and wounding nine. Joining us now to remember that tragic event is Roseanne Chick Canfora, who was an eyewitness and survivor of the May 4th shootings, and whose brother, activist Alan Canfora, who passed away in 2020, was one of the nine Kent State University students wounded. Dr. Chick Canfora is also the chair of the May 4th Commemoration Committee for Kent State University. Thanks so much for joining in.
Thank you for remembering Kent State today.
Absolutely. And if any of our listeners would like to join in on the conversation, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So, Chick, I want to ask you, when you see these protests happening and what's going on nationwide, what are the parallels that you see or that seem reminiscent of what happened on May 4th, 54 years ago on the Kent State campus?
Well, those of us that witnessed and survived the shootings at Kent State have been watching with interest the activities on college campuses across the country. First of all, inspired that they are doing what we did in 1970, and that is to pay attention to what's going on in the world, to see the things that disturb them, and to unite around the common causes that can enable them to speak out and end the injustice that they're seeing. So beyond that inspiration, we also have been watching with some degree of alarm the kind of inflammatory rhetoric of state and federal government leaders, including the U.S. Speaker of the House, in urging campuses to call out the National Guard to advance on peaceful protesters. It's that same kind of inflammatory rhetoric that led to the tragedy at Kent State 54 years ago.
Yeah, so as an eyewitness of the May 4th shootings, there's a traumatic impact it must have on you. And I wonder if that surfaces when you see some of the situations happening on some of the campuses currently.
Well, it does. You know, I watched, you know, with a lot of concern as the police advanced on the students at Columbia. I was happy to see that it was not the kind of excessive force that was used with high-powered military weapons on our campus. But I'm also disturbed to see that the actions of a few that turn violent are painting with a broad brush the peaceful demonstrations of the majority of students who simply are advocating for peace and for justice, and some of them who are just coming into an awareness of how the situation in the Middle East affects the world and just want to talk about it. Instead of closing down campuses, they should be encouraging that dialogue.
You know, we've had Jim from Kent on the line for a while now who wants to share his thoughts. Jim, good morning.
Well, good morning. I had an issue with them calling the current protests pro-Palestinian. I mean, the protests that you're talking about now in May of 1970, they were anti-war protests, and just like the ones against Bush in the early 2000s when he invaded Iraq. And no one called them pro-Vietnam protesters or pro-Iraqi protesters. But for some reason, today, we're calling these protests pro-Palestinian, when really they're anti-war, just like the earlier ones. You know, when you kill kids and kill innocent civilians with bombs, that's always a war crime, and I think that's something that's honorably protested. And good people do protest things like that when you kill kids for nothing.
Jim,
you know, I think Roseanne, I admire her for what she did back in 1970, and I admire the kids today who are standing up against that.
Jim, I appreciate your sentiments. And to Jim's point, Chick, what do you think about how maybe the media, how politicians, how the public broadly categorizes these protests? Do you agree, like Jim, that this is an anti-war movement?
Jim's point is well made. And what we're doing at Kent State on a larger scale, led by the students of the May 4th Task Force, which has focused on the lessons we've learned since it formed in 1975, is finding common ground on these issues and not taking a stance. Instead, our students gathered on the Commons last week in an effort to form a coalition of student groups. There were Jewish students and Palestinian students in that group. There were students that are supporting our trans community and our Latino community and various different factions coming together and saying, what can we all agree on? And what they could agree on that evening was to stand in solidarity with students who are protesting on college campuses and advocating for their universities to keep them safe and enable them to peacefully gather. There is a small number of students, I think, on our campus, and I can't speak for the other campuses, that are taking sides on the issues involving the Israeli government and the Palestinians and what's happening in Gaza. And, you know, their voices should be respected too, but they should not be used to make campuses seem unsafe because students are forming encampments and gathering to talk about the issues in peaceful ways.
So then, with that said, what do you feel is, and I know you've played a role in the public schools in Cleveland, so you have that perspective of an administrator. What do you feel is the responsibility of a university or college administration in dealing with these protests and respecting First Amendment rights, but again, respecting and honoring the sense of inclusion of all students and faculty?
We should not be surprised that all of these actions are happening on college campuses. Our history shows that college campuses always have been a haven for civil disobedience and political dissent, because it's on our college campuses where students go to think and to dream of a better world. We should admire these students today, because strapped with tuition debt and high tuition costs that we weren't strapped with, and working 40-hour work weeks, they don't have the time we did to do that dreaming of a better future. They're finding that time. They're risking their freedom to talk about issues and to form a better world. And I think we should applaud those efforts, and we should respect the Kent State University as a model for others in its pledge to not only promote freedom of speech, but to protect it, unlike our university administration did 54 years ago.
Now, let me ask you this. On Tuesday night, reportedly hundreds of arrests were made on Columbia's campus. Is there a line in which police do need to be involved? I mean, there was a entry of buildings, lots of furniture was kind of thrown around. And at some point, my understanding from our previous reporter, you know, this was where maybe a graduation was going to be held. So what is the line in which there has to be some sort of response?
Well, protesters should respect the law. And the one thing that we do know about protests that become militant, and I know this from my own experience in 1970, students who broke windows in downtown Kent were willing to go to jail for malicious destruction of property if they thought it would draw attention to the destruction of human life across the world. I tell student activists today, that was ineffective. That was wrong to do. But I understand those students who were willing to risk their freedom to make those points. No one was shot down when windows were broken in Kent or when a building was burned in Kent. Students were shot down during a peaceful protest because we weren't just students at Kent State. We were students across the country calling for a national student strike to end the war in Vietnam. That's when we were gunned down, because the power of our voices is the greatest threat. Our voices in unity is the greatest threat to our government's war policies.
So it's interesting, these protests over Gaza and the Israel-Hamas war are reportedly the largest student protests since the Vietnam War. Were you surprised that suddenly there was this swell or uprising in voices that were, convening on campuses and protests? And why do you think this is happening suddenly as compared to, 50 years ago?
Well, I wasn't surprised, because I'm on a college campus and I see our students doing good things, standing up for the rights of their trans peers standing up for against, you know, climate, those that are destroying our climate, taking time to talk about the issues. But what's most important is they're seeing the images of the suffering and the famine and the despair in the Middle East. And they're doing what we did when we saw those same images coming out of Vietnam, when we saw the Tet Offensive and the My Lai Massacre, and we said, we cannot allow these atrocities to be committed in our name.
All right, let's talk about what's happening this weekend, because I know that Kent State has been very good and very thorough in honoring and remembering the students and you know, the tragic events of May 4th. But this has special poignance this year amidst the climate in the nation currently with all these protests. So what will the remembrance look like?
Well, the remembrance is a very solemn event at noon on May 4th. And it begins the night before at midnight when we stand vigil with candles on the spots where our four students died 54 years ago. So this event is a solemn event. Even though we respect the rights of all student voices, we hope that even our students will and others will recognize that these events are to remember and to learn the right lessons from that. We have student organizations, fortunately, that are more political, and they're having their own programs where they continue the dialogues that we're seeing on campuses across the country. But they, I'm assuming, will not interfere with the very solemn and educational efforts of the May 4th Education Committee and Commemoration Committee to honor, recognize, and model the lessons that we've learned from May 4th, 1970.
And let me ask, Chick, your brother has now passed away. And again, he was one of the victims of the May 4 shootings and an activist. What do you think, or can you remember what he thought about how he wanted that event remembered, and if there were any learning lessons from how that was handled, or anything actually good to remember about what students did?
Well, my brother was always grateful that it was students at Kent State in 1975 that joined him and other wounded students in making sure that we have annual commemorations every year. That in 1975, the university administration said there should be no more commemorations. And it was students ever since then that kept the memory of May 4th alive. So my brother was very much a supporter of current students and our need as May 4th eyewitnesses and survivors to make May 4th relevant and meaningful to students today. And I think he'd be very, very happy to see that last year and this year, our keynote speakers on May 4th are our very own students.
And I'm curious, how will you be watching what's unfolding in the nation, and what will you be looking for?
Well, like all of us, probably watching it on my phone because I'm going from event to event at Kent State, but throughout it, I will be hoping that people remember what happened here in 1970, that they tamp down the inflammatory rhetoric, that they stop trying to pit students against each other and against their university administrations, and recognize the power they have in their vote to vote for the legislators and the state and federal level that can actually do something about what's happening in the Middle East, that actually hold the purse strings of that war and stop fighting each other on our college campuses, because that's not where that focus should be.
Chick Canfora, a eyewitness and chair of the May 4th commemoration, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Jenny.
That wraps it up for this show. Now to get the last word on today's topics, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, now X at Sound of Ideas, and you can follow me at JennyHamill_. We're on Instagram at Jenny Hamill Idea Stream. Now, tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, it's the Friday Reporters Roundtable. This week, Mike McIntyre is joined by Idea Stream's Taylor Wisner and Steve Langell, as well as Karen Kassler down at the State House News Bureau in Columbus. Monday on the show, we're going to get more details on the death of Frank Tyson. He died on April 18th while in police custody in Canton, and there has been public outrage over that incident. Now, before we go, we want to make sure you register for our next Sound of Ideas community tour happening 1 week from today. We are going to be at the Cleveland History Center on Thursday night at 6 p.m. in partnership with the Cleveland Orchestra's Humanities Festival. We are going to discuss the intersection of wealth and power, talking about everything from the influence of the Cleveland's Millionaires Row to the effort of hourly workers to gain power and represent themselves, to the impact of persistent racial wealth disparities. It should be a great panel. I'm looking forward to it. Mike McIntyre will be there. So will our whole team. So we hope you'll join us. That's Thursday, May 9th at 6 p.m. Register for the free event at ideastream.org/SOI. Now, if you missed any portion of the program, you can find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast where you get your podcasts. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and I will speak with you again on Monday.